Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 363 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. Today, my guest is Elizabeth Franklin Best. Elizabeth is an attorney in Columbia, South Carolina, who focuses pretty much exclusively on appellate work. So in this episode, you're going to hear how ignorant I am about appellate work. I'm going to show you what very little I know about that area of law, and Elizabeth is going to help educate me first, and hopefully you as well, as to what this involves and how an appellate practice that focuses primarily on federal appeals, as well as some state appeals in, there in South Carolina where she lives, but mostly, you know, federal appeals and mostly white-collar crimes, how that differs from, you know, a solo small firm practice in other areas of the law, how, what the marketing paradigm is and the approach to business development for something like an appellate practice. So without any further delay, here is Elizabeth Franklin Best. Elizabeth Franklin Best, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm delighted to have you with us today on this sunny day in April. Elizabeth, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Elizabeth Franklin Best. I've got an appellate law firm in Columbia, South Carolina. We handle mostly kind of federal appellate work. We do direct appeals. We do federal post-conviction motions like 2255 motions. We do compassionate release petitions. We also handle federal habeas petitions for inmates who have been convicted in state court. And then, you know, I'm licensed in South Carolina. My attorneys are also licensed in South Carolina. So we handle South Carolina state appeals as well. I kind of got at this point, I mean, I'm about 20 years into practicing now. I started off as a public defender, worked a couple of years there. But, you know, my background is a little more, I mean, it's a little nerdy, right? I mean, so I have a couple of degrees in philosophy. I was just always really interested in kind of reading and writing and research and just kind of, you know, just that sort of maybe more academic space. And I just kind of naturally gravitated towards appeals. I worked in our state appellate defender group for about 5 years. And then I went on and handled death penalty work for 7 years, which a lot of that is just really, you know, very kind of heavy on the appellate aspects. We were representing death sentenced inmates in federal court and, you know, kind of state post-conviction. So, you know, anything that didn't involve a trial, I was pretty much like getting involved in. And then about 3 years ago, just a little over 3 years ago now, I just decided I wanted to do something different. I wanted to kind of create the sort of law firm that I would have wanted to go work at when I was first getting out of law school, which is to say, you know, it's just sort of appellate law firm. We just focus on, you know, just in that space. Like I said, mostly federal, but some state work. Our firm is remote. We have kind of weekly meetings with our staff by Zoom. We have monthly luncheons together just to kind of, you know, stay in touch with one another and kind of create that, you know, culture that we hear so much about. But that's it. I mean, mostly we're just sort of working and drafting our appeals and getting those filed in courts kind of throughout the country. And I'm finally kind of doing exactly always wanted to do.
Well, I'm going to share with you the fact that we don't normally talk much about the substantive issues of law on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We talk mostly about the business of law. But I got to take a little detour from that because, you know, I've been a lawyer for a while now, and I got to admit, I don't really know that much about, I was a litigator for a while, and I knew there were such things as appeals, and I never had to file one, thankfully. I would have had to farm it out, because, I mean, you're not going to do that straight off. Fool me a little bit. What, I mean, theoretically,
yeah.
Intellectually, I know what an appeal is, you know, why you have to appeal, or the kinds of things that you might appeal. But we're talking about federal and state, so, you know, and this is criminal work primarily, right? Mm-hmm. Criminal appeals?
Yep.
So what do I need to know about this to be smarter than
the first thing to know is that...
Is it going to be hard? Because I'm really about appellate.
I was going to say, so like the first thing to know is that, I mean, you're not alone. And I mean, it's most people, even, you know, experienced attorneys are just really not familiar with, I mean, I kind of think of it as like the back end of work. I mean, everyone's kind of grown up watching Law and Order. They watch television. So everyone knows what a trial is. You know, it's just part of our culture.
Sure.
But then, you know, you kind of get somebody gets convicted of a crime and people like just literally have no idea, like, okay, what now what? And I say that about, you know, clients and people who have found themselves in that situation. So, I mean, we'll get phone calls where people are like, you know, so what can I do? And so I have to kind of describe, you know, here's what appeals are. You know, as a matter of federal constitutional law, you've got the right to, you know, one appeal once you've been convicted. And your state court will review your case just to see if there are any errors. And if there are, then, you know, the courts have, you know, so the ability to change the case, you know, to change the outcome of the case. They can grant you a new trial. They can, you know, remand for additional hearings or, you know, kind of any number of things. And then after that, you're actually just sort of in this world of like discretionary review. If you lose a direct appeal, you may have an opportunity to do what's called like post-conviction relief, where you raise allegations of like ineffective assistance of counsel, prosecutorial misconduct, more kind of fact-based kinds of issues. And, you know, you have an opportunity to raise that to the court to also kind of reverse your conviction. So there are just kind of like a number of different things that happen on the back end of like a criminal conviction that people can take advantage of in order to, you know, hopefully have their cases reversed. And so that's where we're at. I mean, we'll get phone calls every now and then asking, you know, hey, you know, can you represent me on this kind of front end thing? And we've done a handful of cases, mostly kind of white collar criminal cases on the front end. But then, you know, on the back end, there's just a lot to do. And a lot of it involves research and writing, present, you know, kind of assembling a case with the court on paper. And, you know, that's our space.
So, you know, when you go to a cocktail party and you disclose that you're an attorney, you know, the general public always asks you a question. And I think my level of understanding with respect to appellate work was I would say to people, well, you don't get a second bite of the apple. You know, you can't just appeal because you want to appeal. You didn't like the result. There has to be something substantive to the rationale as to why you're appealing.
Okay.
Am I leading people astray with that bumper sticker description?
No, I mean, you have the right to, you know, to the appeal. You don't have the right to win the appeal. I mean, you're only going to win the appeal if there's actually sort of legal error that the court recognizes. But, I mean, and you can't. You know, you cannot appeal forever, right? I mean, the courts, I just sort of take South Carolina as an example. You know, we allow every convicted person to have one bite at the apple, which means they, you know, they get their trial, they get a direct appeal, And in here, we actually also allow criminal defendants, or criminal, I should say, you know, those convicted of crimes, they also have what's called like a post-conviction relief proceeding.
Right.
And then, yeah, and if they lose that, they get the appeal of that. So that's what South Carolina provides. Pretty much, you know, two hearings, two appeals, and then you're done. Like at that point, South Carolina is just done. Your conviction is final. That's when you can try to, you know, go into federal court on a like a federal habeas petition. I think a lot of states are kind of set up in the same way. I mean, I know that Georgia and North Carolina do. I think other states don't necessarily like appoint counsel for PCRs. South Carolina in fact does, which is nice. And so, yeah, I mean, each state just has its own kind of the way that it's set up. But I know what you mean. I mean, like a lot of people sort of, they believe, they have this kind of false belief that somebody who's been convicted of a crime has innumerable opportunities to reverse that conviction. And that's just not true.
And I think the general public viewpoint is that heavily in criminal cases, largely the big public cases that people follow, they feel like there's an endless supply of appeals that can be addressed and prolonged and strung out. And while it might seem that way, it's not literally the truth. As you said,
that's right. It's not
Carolina,
the truth.
You have a finite number of appeals and conditions under which you can appeal. So as a former litigator, I remember that the most lawyerly thing that I felt was included in the litigation process was the drafting of motion for summary judgment. That seemed to me to be the one that involved the most research, involved the most disciplined application of the law to try and affect an outcome. I get a sense that the appellate work is very, very similar in that respect, and that you, as you said, it's really research-based, and you're looking for errors of process, errors in the application of the law. Am I on the right track there?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I've done some civil work, and a motion for summary judgment looks a lot like a brief. You know, I mean, if you're doing it right, you're pulling in the what's been introduced as evidence or what you've discovered in discovery, and you're telling your story, you know, and it's a piece of advocacy where you're, you know, obviously trying to achieve a particular outcome. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, those who have drafted a number of, you know, motions for summary judgment, I mean, that's sort of exactly what appellate work looks
like. And I remember that was the only pleading, really, that I had to pay attention to blue book formatting of citations.
Right.
What difference between that and the other, run-of-the-mill motion. So it's a different kind of practice of appellate work. You do make your way back into the courtroom on occasion, right?
Yeah. I mean, well, I'll make my way back into a court of appeals or our state Supreme Court or like the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like this year, well, I guess maybe I should start with maybe this past year. Like, I think I maybe had 5 oral arguments this past year. So it's a lot less court, for sure.
There's still the opportunity.
It is a lot less time at court. You know, it's like when you're going up for an oral argument, you'll have your 15 minutes. The respondent will have his or her 15 minutes. Then you'll get like 5 minutes after that. Sometimes it goes on a little bit longer. But, I mean, it's a pretty intense, focused, you know, kind of legal discussion that you have with judges or justices. And it's not, you know, if somebody doesn't know the case and don't know the issues, I mean, you can't just sort of pull up an oral argument and watch it and kind of understand anything about the case, right? I mean, so often, like the discussions in an oral argument, you know, the facts aren't even mentioned. So, and again, it's a very sort of different kind of experience than attending a trial, you know, where the whole point is to sort of tease out the relevant facts and, you know, figure out what happened. You know, the appellate world is more about let's just figure out what the correct application of the law is and, you know, how we can sort of make sure that the law in this case is cohesive with what we've done in other cases, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a different kind of experience.
Now, how did you think that you became enamored with this aspect of the legal process? I mean, you said that you had, you know, some esoteric type undergrad degrees in philosophy and such, which I think is great. But something about this work, I mean, obviously your background, you know, you worked in the PD's office and you saw firsthand, you know, some of these cases that deserved their constitutional right. But, you know, I'd venture to say appellate work is not for everybody. So what drew you to it?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think you're right. And I think that's why we're, you know, there aren't that many of us and almost nobody who just kind of focuses exclusively on appeals like we do, you know, and I think it's kind of a matter of temperament, right? I mean, there are a lot of people who go to law school because they're like, really, you know, they want to be the trial dogs, you know, they're want to kind of get up courtroom and, you know, enjoy that showmanship. And I did that. But it was never really comfortable. You know, it was just never my temperament. I mean, I think it's just sort of a personality, for instance. But I've always loved reading books and I've always loved writing papers. And I mean, it was just very comfortable for me.
So into the research.
Like, yeah.
I get that sense that you kind of, discovering or, you know, illustrating that point with solid research is kind of, you know, what floats your boat.
Yeah, or persuasive arguments, right? Yeah. I mean, like some people, trial lawyers are really great persuaders to a jury, right? I mean, they can sort of speak the juror's language, can be, you know, advocates there. I mean, I'm more comfortable speaking to judges and justices, you know, and about sort of legal issues. And, you know,
would be terrifying, but
I mean, yeah, well, in the same way that it's terrifying for me to have to address a jury, you know, I mean, I just different.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, Lexaclara, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's 5 or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/ELE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game-changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.com
OnceHub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I've been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, you know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com. Now, when we talk about niching down your practice area, I mean, this is really kind of a super niche, if you will. Not only are you focusing on federal crimes and white collar crimes, but exclusively the appellate work associated with those type of practices. I have to think, by definition, it's a different paradigm when you are trying to build that business.
Yeah. I mean, and that's been what I've had to figure out is like how to make it work. Because, I mean, you're right. It's a different looking kind of law practice, you know, than what a lot of people have.
When I switched from family law to estate planning, you know, family law, your marketing principle was you want your name out there so that when somebody, you know, got served with divorce papers or had a custody issue and knew that they needed an attorney, your name was top of mind. But when I switched to estate planning, it wasn't so much that, it was more education. It was educating potential clients as to why it's important to do an estate plan. So the marketing paradigm was completely different between those two practice areas. I have to believe that the marketing paradigm is a minimum, and just simply the business of running a practice like yours has to be necessarily different from most other law practices.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you know, one of the things about my practice is that most of my clients are incarcerated. And so when I've had to kind of figure out like how to get business, you know, a lot of it focused on kind of servicing an incarcerated population and figuring out what they need and how their needs are different than, you know, somebody who is surfacing a criminal charge, you know. So one thing I like to do is I send newsletters to clients, trying to keep them up to date with like sort of advances in the law, kind of changes in the law. Because when you're incarcerated, you don't have access to that sort of information. And so that kind of information can be highly valuable. And so that's one way like I've been able to kind of generate some, I mean, my client base is being able to kind of give people in, you know, the Bureau of Prisons or the Department of Corrections kind of what they need in terms of information. And so that was really, that was helpful.
I was about to make some joke. Like, it's not like you can put an ad in the prison newspaper, but in reality, which you took, you're sending them the newspaper.
And the prison system is a closed environment. I mean, so word can travel fast.
Well, I would imagine so, yeah.
If you've got, you know, some positive relationships with some clients, I mean, they will spread your name. And so that's just been, you know, getting referrals from other clients is probably our number one way of getting business.
Yeah. You know? I would think so. And how about from other attorneys?
Yeah. I mean, we get a lot of referrals from other attorneys. I mean, you know, guys who represented somebody at trial and, you know, if they don't want to handle the appeal, they send them our way. So we get a lot that way. And then, you know, my website, I do blog posts and I've got sort of videos. And again, it's kind of this almost pedagogical sort of perspective. I mean, I like to kind of teach people sort of what they need to know about the system. And so I'll do, you know, blog posts about particular cases that may be of interest to those who are convicted of crimes. in the process of appealing their cases. So that really is, I mean, there's such an education gap for those who have been convicted of crimes. You know, they don't know what to do next. They don't really know what the appellate process is. They certainly don't know what federal post-conviction is. They don't know what the rules of federal habeas are. They don't know what a compassionate release petition is. So I try to kind of, you know, educate as to those things as a way of, you know, just kind of part of what our mission is about in the firm.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting to me because, you know, I think we all have preconceived ideas of what the population is like amongst those who have been convicted of a crime. And it's not a homogenous population. I think
Not at all.
Clearly, there's a lot of different variations and kind of levels to this. And, you've been focusing on federal crimes and federal appeals and white collar crimes, that you're dealing with one segment of the population. And even within that, I suspect it's not a homogenous, grouping of folks.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
So each of them bring different experiences. Experiences and educational levels and understanding of the law, and just think it has to be fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing. I mean, you know, you'll find there are definitely different kinds of clients who I think are in the state system versus the federal system. I mean, we just don't really appreciate how wide the net is in federal court, how broadly they can, you know, ensnare people into, you know, prosecution. I mean, a lot of just kind of, you know, people running their own businesses, medical professionals, tax people, I mean, business owners. I mean, there's just been a lot of people from the professional class, you know, into the federal system.
Yeah, that ain't going to be my question, because you come across all different kinds of clients. And is there kind of one that's, sticks out more than the other, or that seem more prevalent, or has there been a change in that population in the time that you've been practicing, or,
As somebody who started off doing state work, you know, I can tell you that the state population typically is less educated, it happens to be more African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
When you walk into a prison, it's mostly African Americans.
Yeah.
In the state,
its own message.
Yeah, I mean, in this federal system, I mean, I think there's still quite a significant racial disparity, but less kind of economic disparity.
Mm-hmm.
I've encountered a lot of fairly wealthy, or, you know, at least moneyed, defendants in the federal system. But I mean, again, that's, you know, because those are the kind of crimes that the feds are seeking to, you know, to prosecute. Are some of the financial crimes and that sort of thing.
Right. And so you talked about your staff. Tell us a little bit how you constructed the office. You said you're all remote primarily, and which was that the case before the pandemic, or is it a result of the pandemic, or is that just by design?
It's kind of, I mean, it is post-pandemic. I mean, you know, like everyone else, right, when COVID hit and everything was shutting down. And, I mean, the court shut down pretty darn quickly.
Oh, yeah. And completely.
And completely. And I have to say, like, we just didn't really feel a lot of those negative consequences because we were representing people on appeal. So we weren't going into courtrooms anyway. And we kind of figured it would be about, you know, it would be sometime after COVID when the court started opening back up, that we would begin to feel like our slowdown, you know, because we knew at some point we were going to be impacted by the fact that there was, you know, for a year and a half, no trials happening.
Yeah.
But you know, it also kind of gave us an opportunity to just really kind of get smart about the technology. I mean, we're a small firm. We've got three lawyers and a paralegal, and we're about to get a fourth attorney sometime this summer. So we were able to pivot pretty quickly and just, you know, figure out the technology, how to sort of jump on a Zoom link, how to just, you know, coordinate our efforts. And so when things started opening up again, I mean, I had this cute little office, like this nice little sort of commercial district in downtown Columbia. I really loved my office. Brought my dog in. I mean, it was like, it was sure. quite nice. And then my landlord comes and says, oh, we're going to be raising your rent by about 25%. And I started thinking about it. I'm like, you know, I've got this conference room that I use like once a month. I mean, what am I really paying for? And it just seemed like we just sort of experimented. And we tried doing like 3 days working from home and then 2 days in the office. So we did that for about 6 months. And then I was like, you know what? I feel pretty comfortable if we just do this remotely. And so I've got a small office kind of near my home with an area for another paralegal at some point. But we've just been able to kind of make this work through our Zoom calls, our yeah. monthly luncheons. And, you know, I love the flexibility. You know, as somebody who is a writer, I mean, we're all kind of working on appeals. I think it's helpful that there aren't a whole lot of people in an office. You know, it's better for yeah. our concentration and for focusing.
Sure. Your productivity is enhanced.
Our productivity is enhanced. And yeah.
It does sound like something that, you know, a practice area that does lend itself particularly well to remote work.
I think that's right. I mean, this isn't for everybody for sure. But appeals, this is sort of a good area of the law to practice.
So one of the things that we will always talk about in terms of the technology in the office of, you know, practice management software, you know, keep track of the clients and information and tasks and all that. Is that as important in appellate work as it might be in a litigation or a transactional based office?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we use MyCase case management system. That's how one thing about having clients who are incarcerated is that they have loved ones on the outside, you know, who are always want to sort of know like what's their loved ones' cases. There's a lot of, you know, hang time and appellate law. So, I mean, a lot of kind of times where there's just literally nothing happening in a case. So we've got a portal system through MyCase where family members can just like send us an email. We get right on top of it. We share documents with them. And I mean, our clients and their family members especially really appreciated it.
Sure.
But that's been, that's been real.
Do you have to get any kind of special authorization from the clients to share that information with family members and loved ones?
Yep. When we open a case, we will get releases from our clients and we'll have our clients fill out a list of who all they want us to talk to. You know, and if somebody's on that list, we don't talk to them. But if they give us permission to talk to somebody, we will.
And then how about in terms of billing? I'm not asking rates or anything, but how do you go about billing the clients? Is it a fixed fee? Is it hourly? Or is it, I just don't know.
Hourly? Yeah, we do hourly. So we'll just sort of take a retainer to begin a case. And I've calculated the retainer so that likely that the retainer will just cover the whole fee of it. I mean, I've been doing this long enough. I've got a pretty good sense of like how many hours it's going to take. So we'll get that in place if it dips below a certain amount. So we also keep an evergreen retainer. If it below a certain amount, then we'll ask them to replenish it. And then we invoice, you know, actually twice a month. So we'll send out invoices, just sort of list exactly what we've done on the case so that they can see, you know, where their money's going and what's been done. So we believe in just kind of a real sort of almost radical transparency when it comes to legal fees. That has been, you know, in my experience, real source of frustration for a lot of clients and their families and other, you know, environments. And so when we were designing the way that we were going to operate, we just wanted to address that.
And we had do you build it out of my case, or do you have a separate billing program?
I choose my case.
Okay.
Yeah. That tracks all of our invoicing. And yeah, I really like my case, I have to say. I mean, it's been just a great thing for streamlining how our business works.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful platform. Been around a while. I may be misstating this, but I think it was created by attorneys.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Because I know I interviewed them at an EBA tech show at one point.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and then how about in terms of internal communications? I mean, you mentioned Zoom. What do you do with your staff? Is it all email? You use Slack or some other platform?
You know, I've played around with Slack and Loom and things like that. We don't really need anything that complicated right now. I mean, there's just four of us, and so an email works.
This works just as
you know, we're fine with email. Like I can envision a future where we've got, you know, two or three more lawyers where we may have to do something else, but you know, I want to kind of stay simple until you have to get complicated.
And how about calendar?
Yep.
Right. So the very.
I mean,
very
it does everything.
Yeah. It's a very integrated
package.
And, you know, I'm pleased to see that you're using it for as many functions as you are. There's a lot of people who have my cases, you know, their practice management or something similar, but they bill out of a different program and they calendar out of a different program. And so they're only ever using a fraction of any of these platforms that they have stitched together. I'm pleasantly surprised to hear that you're doing it almost exclusively within one platform, because I think that's the kind of thing it was designed to do.
Yeah, but I mean, if it ever goes down, we are screwed. I mean, that's for real.
But it's still cloud based, right? So you have access to it from wherever you're at. So that's a plus. So yes, let's hope that the internet gods look kindly upon you. Well, listen, Elizabeth, it's been really delightful for me to have an opportunity to chat with you. I've learned so much. You know, obviously demonstrated how ignorant I was to start with. So I couldn't help but learn something while listening to you. But tell our audience how they may reach out to you if they want to follow up and pick your brain about how they may start and follow up practice in their neck of the woods.
Yeah, sure. So our website is just www.elizabethfranklinbest.com. Our office is 803-445-1333. And that's just kind of where we're at. I mean, we're on Facebook and LinkedIn and, you know, fun stuff like that. But always happy
to ask you about this. We didn't even ask you about your social media, but because I know that you're on all the platforms there. So we'll have all that in our show notes, and our audience will be able to kind of connect with you if that's something that they're interested in. Just want to thank you again for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur, and I wish you all the best going forward.
All right. Well, so nice to meet you, and thank you again for having me.
It's terrific. Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them, and I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client, and then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just
what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.